Thank you, Dr. Moeller. I am very humbled to be at Southern Theological Seminary. I am indeed honored and a little bit burdened. It's a very different thing for me to speak in a chapel or a church. I have almost always turned down opportunities to do that, believing that individuals are gifted and called by God to speak from platforms by this very specifically, and that while I've been given a couple of gifts, one of them is not preaching. And so I wanted to begin with a disclaimer that I am not now, nor have I ever been a theologian, and I didn't stay at a Holiday Inn. I stayed at your beautiful hotel here last night. I also want to say that I'm honored by the friendship of Dr. Moeller. And as Al pointed out, we have been in conversation most Mondays for the better part of a decade. It is my ambition in life to have read a book that Dr. Moeller has not read before me. If you're on these conference calls and you bring up a book and you want to recommend to the colleagues on the editorial board of the Salem Radio Network, about which more later, you'll volunteer. I think people ought to read Lawrence Wright's The Looming Tower. And Al will have read it and have annotated it and will suggest a particular page which you might want to refer to. And that happens with a regularity which astonishes but no longer surprises me. And so it's been a joy, as he said, to participate in these conversations. And when he extended this invitation, I couldn't turn him down because I know what the mission of this institution is. It's a volcano of leadership. And it throws out leaders across the world. And long it's done that, and long may it do so. And to any bit of contribution I can add to that process, I'm grateful for the opportunity. But I want to begin as well with this acknowledgement. The examples I will use of leaders may not be, in the minds of some people here, good or exemplary leaders. And I have in mind Hebrews chapter 12, verse 15, "See to it that no one misses the grace of God and that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many." So please, if I bring forward someone whose name is a leader you find to be objectionable, you put it aside and understand that I understand that you might consider that individual not to be exemplary, and that you might have a different individual in mind as a leader. And I understand that, and I do not use these examples as norms, but only as those who have influenced me in the way I think leadership ought to go. And I would suggest you begin with your own leader, Dr. Moeller. For the reason I have said, he is well-read, he is deeply learned, he is also fearless, he is courageous, but as I said to him this morning, he's gracious. And gracious is hard to do in this culture. Last night I was with Dr. Moeller and Mrs. Moeller, and of course I ended up in the library looking at the library. And I was given a copy of a manuscript that he will be issuing next year. I won't tell you what's in it, you'll have to wait. But as I said to him this morning, I was up late reading it, as is my practice. I begin at the beginning for the first chapter, then I go to the end of a book, and then I decide if the middle is worth reading. And indeed, it is. But it is marked by that very characteristic graciousness, winsomeness, which the church really needs to practice and recapture from, I believe, the early church forward. And so it's an honor to be here. Knowing that I was coming, I was here last week. I was in Louisville for the second time in a week after not having been here for 6 or 7 years since my last trip. And when you know you're about to give a lecture on leadership, you begin to observe around you those examples of leaders that are near you. So I had a pretty interesting week in that department as I sat down to write this. A week ago, I was with the then minority leader, now majority leader-elect of the United States Senate, Mitch McConnell, with Governor Bobby Jindal, with Carly Fiorina, with Matt Bevin. And those are four extraordinarily different but gifted sorts of leaders, two of them from industry, Carly and Matt, extremely successful, focused business leaders. One of them, Carly, the first woman to lead a Fortune 20 company in America. Governor Jindal is a tornado of achievement. He makes all of us feel like the dumbest kid in the class and the one who is always left behind, the last kid picked on the team, the one who doesn't want to be. Because Bobby Jindal is simply a whirlwind of intellectual activity and achievement. And if you look at his resume, and if there is ever an opportunity to get him here for this lecture, it would be extraordinary because he has led from the time he really took first breath. And of course, Leader McConnell has the name, leader. What a title to be given. You are the leader of the Senate, the world's greatest deliberative body. How Robert Byrd used to love to say that. And to be called the leader means you're invested with an incredible amount of authority and responsibility. Yet he is calm and quiet. He is the anti-charismatic candidate. He is the proof positive that American politics does not depend upon a rugged chin and a dimple or a gleaming smile, but he is in fact a master of the Senate. And as a master of the Senate, there's great hope for us in his leadership. And I thought of those four different examples as how broad the expanse of the canvas on which I'm painting. Then on Monday night, it was a completely different experience. I was with a small group of my fellow church members in Southern California, hearing the testimony of David, who I will not name in his last name. He's active in the ministry Elam.com, which is a ministry for Iranian Christians. Not surprisingly, I brought this up last night to Dr. Moeller, and he knew more about Iranian Christians than I did by a lot. He's actually taught Iranian Christians in Turkey in the persecuted church. But David is a leader of the persecuted church, and it's a very different set of skills than those four individuals I mentioned earlier. He was inspiring, and I was inspired. And I had actually confessed, never thought that the problem of Iran could be answered by the solution of the gospel. I'd been a little bit limited until Monday night. And this man had traveled from England to tell a small group of 10 people about his ministry. And I thought to myself, what a committed fellow to cross an ocean to talk to 10 people about his ministry to the persecuted church in Iran. On Tuesday night, of course, as Dr. Moeller referenced, is one of the four great elections of my 58 years. The other three being 1980, 1994, and 2000. 2010 was important, maybe that's number fifth, but this was number four. 2000, of course, brought to us the leadership of W, which I'll talk about a little bit later, at a time of great stress and sorrow for America. 1980 brought the change in America's direction that defeated the Soviet Union. 1994 restored constitutional order and balance. And 2014, I believe, will be seen as a turning point. And as a result, what a great night it was. And I was talking on the radio that night with a host of people, but I was aware that I was able to do that because of the leadership of two extraordinary individuals, Edward Atzinger and Stuart Epperson. I'm curious how many of you know their names. Would you show me your hand if you know their names? They're not very well known. Perhaps two of the ten most influential Christians in modern America. When they graduated from Bob Jones University 50 years ago, they didn't have any money. They only had a dream, and they have built the Salem Radio Network. Salem Communications is actually what it's called. It was originally a radio network. Now it's a vast, multi-platform megaphone of both conservative, but far more important to them, evangelical values that broadcast not just over their radio stations, but to the entire world via a variety of platforms and publishing houses, through the internet, through properties that are as diverse as Red State and Regnery Publishing, and every Christian radio station that they own 100 of them. These two individuals set out to build and change the world, and they did. And as I say, they had no assets, they only had vision, coming out of Bob Jones University 50 years ago. I wonder who among the students here are the Eppersons and the Atzingers of 2064. I really do wonder which one of you and how many of you will step up to do that. They built the platform I was able to use on Tuesday night. And in that platform, I was able to talk to two different kinds of leaders. Three, actually. Reince Priebus, Paul Ryan, Rob Portman. Lots of P's in there. Paul Ryan, Reince Priebus, Rob Portman. You have to be able to say that three times. But they're all men of accomplishment sitting in positions of power, welcoming to their number in Washington, D.C. And if you read your New York Times this morning, an extraordinarily diverse group of new leaders, Mia Love, Shelley Moore Capito, the extraordinary Joni Ernst, Tom Cotton, Ben Sasse, new young people rising up in Washington, D.C. The New York Times chose to profile six this morning. These three were eager for new leaders to join them. So as I did this, as I watched this all week long, I was amazed at the variety and types and talents of leaders that show up. And so I'm aware that whatever I say is a generality, and it may not be applicable to you or in this room, in this chapel, or watching on the internet, or reading these words when I eventually get around to publish them. But I will say that there are some commonalities. And the most important one is, Lord, do we need leaders? And I say that as much as an observation as a prayer. Lord, do we need leaders? People who will step up like these individuals I've talked about, whether they are in the position of leadership here at a seminary or going into a position of leadership in the United States Senate like Tom Cotton, or whether they're running a platoon of Marines in Afghanistan, or whether they're teaching in an inner city school in Great Expectations or Great Heart Schools, one of the ones of the great charter schools in Arizona. No matter where they are, Lord, do we need leaders? My observations thus are going to be based on one rule. I had to have personally experienced it. I will not have simply read about it except for the very last example. And I base that because Eric Metaxas, a friend of mine, I was with him last week, recently wrote a new book called Miracles. And he thought he would limit his writing only to those miracles about which he could gather first-person testimony. He did not want to rely upon hearsay. And those of us in the law understand that hearsay has some probative value, but it is often fractured at critical moments. So he went out and he limited his great book, and I would recommend Miracles to you. He'll be on the radio with me again tomorrow, and I've already interviewed him once about this, to only those testimonies that he could actually look into the eyes of the individual telling him about God's intervention in the natural world and then be satisfied that they were true. Thus, I am limiting my remarks to personal experience. This was also the rule I set down for myself when I wrote my most recent book, The Happiest Life. Dr. Moeller was kind enough to refer to the fact I've been in broadcast for a long time. I've actually done more than 20,000 interviews, one-on-one interviews, with individuals, not counting callers to the radio show. If you start in 1989 and you do as many reps and you do 3 hours a day, 15 segments a day, 75 segments a week, and the syndicated show is now entering its 15th year, and before that I did 10 years of television and 3 years of weekend radio, you get the reps. And indeed, Malcolm Gladwell said you got to do something 10,000 times in order to get pretty good at it. Well, 20,000 interviews, and I'm now comfortable with asking people the most obvious of questions, the ones that people want asked, and sometimes people are embarrassed to answer. And so when I wrote The Happiest Life, I wanted to reverse engineer those 20,000 interviews back into the qualities of individuals that I had thought had successfully led a happy life. And I came up with qualities which will not surprise you. They're nothing extraordinary. Energy, enthusiasm, encouragement, empathy, good humor, generosity, and gratitude. And I was very comfortable with using first-person observation to get back to that. So I used the same method in preparing the McCall leadership. I was only going to use examples that I had personally experienced to give you any rules for leadership. And most of them are drawn from three men with whom I've had the opportunity to work and relate over the course of the 58 years I've been here. And I think these rules apply. And I remind you again of Hebrews 12:15. If they're not your cup of tea, at least suspend your judgment of them until such time as I can tell you why I think they're leaders. The first man I came to know after his own spectacular failure, a failure of historical proportions, and he will always and forever be associated with that failure. In 1978, I graduated from Harvard and I headed west for my first job with David Eisenhower. And shortly after joining with David as a research assistant, the invitation came from former President Nixon to join his personal staff at the Elba of America, San Clemente. He was in exile, he was disgraced, he had finished the Frost interviews in his memoirs, and his keen writing staff, Frank Gannon, Ken Kachigian, and of course, our nightly news anchor, Diane Sawyer, had left, and he was rebuilding his writing staff. And he asked me to join it. And I said, of course I'll join it. This was an opportunity for a young 22-year-old man to spend hours every day with the individual who'd been the leader of the free world, but he'd also been disgraced. He'd fallen. At his funeral, Henry Kissinger said, he stood on pinnacles which dissolved into precipices. And that is indeed what his life was like. But what an opportunity to spend hours every day as a 22-year-old individual in the company of a senior statesman who had shook hands with Churchill, had debated Khrushchev, had negotiated with Brezhnev, had sat down with Mao, had done all these amazing things. So I love that. And in the course of that, I wrote two books, the first of which I helped him write two books. I want to be very careful. He was himself the writer of his books. But he had an editorial team that would look up and research and offer comments. The first was called The Real War, and it was about the Soviet Union. It appeared in time for the critical election of 1980. And the second was, appropriately enough, called Leaders. And it was about those individuals whom he had worked with over this extraordinary career, whom he singled out, including Golda Meir and Lee Kuan Yew, people you might not have heard of or spend much time thinking about, but who impressed him. And he wrote about this book on leadership. And from all of that experience, there's one thing I would say to you who are young, especially to know about Richard Nixon, that he can teach you. There is no setback that is final. There is no permanent failure. He was at the lowest point of anyone in American politics in 1974. No one had ever resigned the presidency of the United States in disgrace under the threat of impeachment. And yet, by the time of his death, 20 years after that resignation, he had ascended again to a position of respect and indeed of wisdom that was sought out by leaders around the world, including members of both parties, as they sought to negotiate their way through a post-Soviet Union world that required a skill set that only he had. He could have curled up and died, and indeed he almost did, but nothing stopped the drive of a genuine leader to express his or her talents no matter what situation has confronted you. And I take that away and I give it to you and I ask you, study Nixon. Al made one minor error in his introduction. I didn't build the Reagan Library, I built the Nixon Library. And it was in Yorba Linda. And President Nixon called me back in 1989 from Washington, D.C., where I expected to live my life. And I was willing to go because he gave so much to me. A minor second point about leaders. The best ones are always investing in young people. Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Al Mohler always have about them young people who they understand from the context of British history, private secretaries. They would bring in young men of the empire, eventually young women of the empire as well, and assign them the job of carrying the briefcase for a great man or a great woman. Maggie Thatcher had her aides as well, and she was a great woman. And all they would do is basically fetch. And I enjoyed my time as a briefcase carrier for Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan because I got to see things and remember things that have had a profound influence on my life. If the opportunity comes along, do not think it beneath your dignity to serve as the guy who is the body man and the getter of water. It is a great opportunity. The second individual I want to talk about, very different from Nixon, a quiet man. He's a scholar, funny, and he's brilliant, amazingly gifted writer. He has a terrible jump shot because I played on the White House basketball team with him. But he was my suite mate for the year that I served in the White House as an assistant counsel, and he is now the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts. Now, I'm quick to disclaim friendship. I've only seen him once, in fact, since he became the Chief Justice, and that was only fleeting. So what I say about his leadership on the court is speculative. It's based on a knowledge of his intellect and his humor and his great capacity for brilliance, but I have no special knowledge and no one should understand my comments to be other than that of a far away observer of an individual I knew a long time ago. I think he is a great leader. He is, first of all, humble. John Roberts was easily the smartest lawyer in a room full of very smart lawyers. The White House counsel's office has been called, and rightly so, the finest law firm in the world. There were only seven, and we only had one client, and that client was Ronald Reagan, and every White House counsel only has one client. The Department of Justice has the United States government at its client, sometimes at odd with the president, but the White House counsel's office, they serve only the president. And we were led by Fred Fielding, who's done that job three times. He's one of the great wise men of Washington, D.C., an old-style leader. And he brought in a lot of different talent sets, and I think he brought me in because I'm pretty good with a noun and a verb, and I can scribble. John Roberts is the real deal when it comes to capacity and the Constitution. And no one knew that from his lips. Extremely humble. The last guy in the world to tell you that he was the most talented guy in the room. And I think that's true mostly about the leaders that I have known. Some have been a little bit more voluble than others when it comes to extolling their abilities. In politics, you sometimes have to be willing to tell people about what you have done in order to rise, but not the Chief Justice. And the second thing I really want you to take away about Roberts is his courage. You know, there was an easy way for him in the Sebelius case about the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. It would have been very easy for the Chief Justice to declare it unconstitutional. There is a principle in constitutional law, though, that if there is any way to uphold a statute of the United States Congress, you must do so. It's an ethical obligation. There are many arguments, one of them from my good friend, Mark Levin, and he is a good friend. We served in the Department of Justice together. That the Chief Justice inappropriately applied the tax clause of the United States Constitution. That's an argument over the merits of his argument, not over the sincerity of it. However, he took that act when he could have talked himself into a different way, and indeed some legal scholars, and I do not know the answer to this, and again, I underscore, I have not talked to him about this, believe he was originally with the dissent, that he might have written the dissent, that there are clues that he did write the dissent, that was to be the majority opinion that would have struck down Obamacare. But for whatever reason, and there are many reasons that I will not bore you with them now because it isn't a constitutional law class, I believe he played the long game and did the right thing and upheld the act, which many of us do not find at all useful to the United States, and many of which had hoped to have had struck down by the court, and which yet may be struck down under a different argument, the origination clause, should it reach the Supreme Court in the next term. But he had the courage to do that, and if you're going to be a leader, you know what you've got to be ready for? A lot of criticism, and not just from your opponents, and certainly from your enemies, but from people you might have counted on for a great deal of support, who you might have thought would give you the benefit of the doubt. And I have never seen that more clearly displayed than in the reaction to the Chief Justice's opinion in Sebelius. National Independent Federation of Business versus Sebelius, because the criticism was withering and it was personal. And it did not in any way impact him as far as I can tell. Certainly, it must have grieved him. If you cut me, do I not bleed sort of thing. But leaders do what leaders have to do, even when they know that those upon whom they've counted for support will not be there for them. And aside, the same thing happened with Harriet Myers when she was nominated. And how deeply disappointed George W. Bush must have been in the people whom he had served and whom he had tried to lead in their lack of faith in his judgment. And I was a great supporter of the Myers nomination. I do not like a Supreme Court made up only of judges and of scholars and of Harvard and Yale graduates. I think a few lawyers from the big firms and even from the small firms and maybe even a non-lawyer would be good for our body of 9 unelected justices, a majority of whom Justice Scalia likes to say make the law in the United States. How unrepresentative that they are all from Harvard and Yale law schools. How absolutely contrary to what the framers intended for that court. Nevertheless, it is what it is, and leaders have to be ready for getting hit from behind. James Taylor, I don't know if he's been quoted from this before, ain't it just like a friend of mine to hit me from behind? All right, that's going to North Carolina in my mind, one of my favorite James Taylor songs. I think about that with the Chief Justice. I think about that with W. And it's just something you're going to have to get used to. And I'll bet you if Dr. Mueller unbended, there would be times when he wondered. Honestly, I was not expecting to get hit from that direction. And when you get clipped, you get up. The third leader I want to talk about, an extraordinary individual. And when all of these people I talk about writing with them, working with them, it's in different ways. But the third individual is another spectacular failure in the eyes of the world, Mitt Romney. Governor Romney came to my attention in 2006 when my publisher called and said I owed them a book under a contract. And I was asked to please produce a book in time for the election of 2008. And I looked around and I saw this governor of Massachusetts whom I never met, who was a Mormon. I'd become acquainted with Mormons through my work for PBS on a series called Searching for God in America, and one of their apostles, the elder Neil Maxwell, became a good friend of mine. But of course, my theology is not his theology, and we just agreed to disagree, and I approached the church as a journalist, intrigued by it, and then I was intrigued by the proposition whether Mitt Romney, as a Mormon, could actually win the White House in the day and age in which it mattered what you believed as a matter of faith. When his father sought the White House in 1968, I read every book about that campaign. No one gave more than a paragraph to his faith or to the controversial nature of it, but America has changed. So I arranged and battered at the door of Mitt Romney until finally the inner circle let me in, and I spent a lot of time with him, talking with him, interviewing him for a book that became A Mormon in the White House? And the very first time I sat down with Governor Romney, I told this story to Dr. and Mrs. Mueller last night. The very first question he asked in the State House of Massachusetts, surrounded by the portrait of John Adams and all these amazing founders and framers, it's a place to go. It's a beautiful building. It's like this building. First question, are you a grandfather? Now, at the time, I was 52. Now I'm 58. I was a little taken aback. How could you think I'm a grandfather? I'm a young man. But of course I have white hair. And I said, no, I'm not a grandfather. My children aren't that old. I am now, by the way, and it's a wonderful thing. But at that time, he said, well, the reason I ask, don't be offended, is because your whole worldview changes when you become a grandfather. Every decision that you take becomes a decision that is not about what's good for your kids, but what's good about your grandchildren. And therefore, your time span extends out, and you begin to think not in terms of decades, but of generations. I thought that was profound. And as I studied Romney, and I did make a study of him, and the book is what I thought of him, I found him to be a good and wonderful man whose attachment to his family and his faith defined him. And would that everyone of my faith had the same attachment to their family and their faith that he does. Would that my denomination have the same evangelical fervor of his and the same commitment. It's here, by the way, on the campus of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville. This is where you find that same, but it is rare in our church. It is common among the LDS. And that is something that we ought to study, how they develop that. But what I want you to take away from Romney is that his life of extraordinary achievement was completely compatible with the raising up of five wonderful men, and they are five wonderful men, all of whom have produced wonderful families for him, a lifelong devotion to his wife, and through sickness in health and good times in bad. It is not inconsistent with a public life or a life in the private sector of extraordinary success or of a political calling to remain true to your family and your faith and to serve both. And I think that is the example of Romney for all of us. So keep that in mind, and keep it in mind especially because when I reflect upon the call of leadership right now, I'm staggered by what the young people on this campus are facing. I mean, genuinely staggered. When I came out of college, there was the Soviet Union. And when I sat down with Nixon in San Clemente and talked about the Soviet Union, it was the only problem, one problem. And it was an atheist culture. That was an advantage in retrospect. They had no hereafter to live for. They had no desire to destroy the world. It's all they had. Now we are confronted by enemies, both natural in the form of Ebola and ideological in the form of ISIS, which are just two of the many icebergs that are out there facing this culture in a multipolar world with a rising PRC, with a resurgent Russia that is more czarist than communist, and with diseases and with fanatics, it's staggering. I don't know how many of you have read the Patrick O'Brien sea stories. How many of you have read the sea stories of Maturin and Aubrey? If you have not done so, I would encourage you to do so. David Mamet, America's greatest living playwright, told me that the finest conversational literature of our age was written by Patrick O'Brien, and that he based his conversation in his magnificent plays on the dialect and the timing of the interplay between Captain Jack Aubrey and Stephen Maturin. There are 21 of these adventure novels. A lot of it is about sailing, and I have no idea what they're talking about. I listen to every one of them on my morning runs and walks, because what they did is they captured a period of a decade of the Napoleonic Wars at sea. And through all these 21 stories, it left me with the impression, you know, that's a journey, that career at war. And all of you are setting out on a similar long journey. And there are going to be icebergs, and there are going to be desert islands, and there are going to be battles, and there are going to be long stretches of nothing except the day-to-day business of sailing your ship. And it is a great metaphor for your life, these 21 books. So if I take anything away from this, you'll thank me if you go off and begin to listen to the first one. And listen, I do listen to these books. They're beautifully read. The Patrick O'Brien books will cost you a few pennies, but I listen to them because the English reader is just so talented. With this in mind, and all these examples, I wanted to do a couple of things. I wanted to give you five practical tips. I wanted to give you my shortcut connector, and I wanted to close with a few observations about one last leader and one observation from history. My five practical tips, because I am a lawyer, and lawyers believe in the here and now, and the getting through of the day, and the drawing up of documents. The first one is very simple. Be fit. Be fit. The reason W was able to be president, I think the reason President Obama is able to endure it, is because they have worked long and hard at having bodies ready to put up with that. When President Reagan was shot, and there's an amazing book called Rawhide Down by Del Wilber, They opened him up on the operating table and they marveled at the insides of a 40-year-old, and he was 70 plus. And why was he that? Because he rode every day and he chopped wood and he was physically in the game. And it's necessary. If you're going to lead, you're going to have to take care of yourself. And that means no excessive attachment to alcohol, no excessive attachment to tobacco, no drugs, and a moderate regime of exercise that isn't crazy. Number two, as I said about Romney, you cannot spend too much time with your spouse and your children. Those commitments that will drive and define your life and will destroy your leadership are so essential. I have seen so many men and women lose their leadership because they lost first their attachment to spouse and family. And that's when they fall. And that's what you have to be able very intentionally to reserve time for, as Governor Romney does, as I know Al does, as I do. Number three, always be reading. And I mean really reading, not blogs, not Twitter, I do that too, but books. And not just serious books. You'll hear me on my radio show talk with Lawrence Wright on Friday. I've already taped the interview. In the third hour, I talked with Rajiv Chandrasekaran of the Washington Post about his new book, For Love of Country, which I read yesterday on the airplane here. So I read books, and I believe in reading serious books, important books, but I also believe in reading fun books. The Sea Stories of Patrick O'Brien. I've read every single Daniel Silva novel, every single Mitch Rapp thriller that came from my late friend, Vince Flynn. I read all the C.J. Box mysteries. I just love reading, and I believe it is a habit. Every Brad Thor book that comes out, I can't wait. I dive into it, so I'm profligate when it comes to thrillers and things that I like, because you've got to have some fun. You've got to be entertained. But I also believe you've always got to be reading a book. And if you're not, and the example of your president here is, I think, in this regard, completely compelling and authentic. You've got to keep your mind open to the flow of ideas and data that come from unexpected sources and to the story of human beings as told not just in our theology text and not just in scripture, though that, of course, is the first source for everything, but in novelists' imagination. Dr. Muller's new book, he begins quite surprisingly with Flannery O'Connor. And I was taken aback by this, the great Catholic novelist, and I thought, that's so Al. He gave me a surprise on the first page by referring to the great Catholic novelist of our age. So maybe Walker Percy is the other one, but do it. Number four, embrace social media, but with discipline and purpose. Now, the young people here, I honestly don't know how you're going to raise your kids. Taylor Swift gave an interview last week, which I thought was very moving. She said, you've got to teach your kids to get over it, that the harassment that is coming their way will be constant and tidal. It will come in and it will go out. And sometimes it will be tsunami-like. And they're going to have to learn to deal with it. The constant harassment, the constant vulgarity, the intrusiveness of pornography, the absolute battering ram of incivility. It's there. It's like oxygen. And so if you don't train yourself up on how to defend yourselves and your family and especially your children against it, they will be without walls. So I don't know how you do it here. I know Dr. Muller and I have been talking about this for a long time, about his loathing of anonymity on the internet. And I hate anonymity on the internet. If you won't sign your name to it, you're a coward. And if you pay any attention to anything put out by cowards, you are ill-served. But nevertheless, it's there. And it's there in such overwhelming quantities. Our mutual friend Ross Douthat and I were together last week. We're talking about the comment sections. I removed mine from my blog. Ross doesn't read that in the New York Times. They fill up with hate. I mean, it's really devil spawn stuff sometimes that you wonder, who are these people? Why are they so unhappy? What's wrong with their lives? But I don't know what to advise you here except that you must be aware of it. I know that the seminary is, and I know it's training, and new leaders have to be prepared for dealing with it. It will require extraordinary discipline. There was a facility erected at Camp Pendleton in Southern California about 6 years into the Iraq conflict, and General Mattis arranged for it. And Colonel Lathine, his chief of staff, invited me down as a journalist to go through it. And it was a simulation of a small Iraqi town and marketplace. And young Marines, before they went to deploy in Anbar province, would go through it again and again and again. And the bad guys would shoot rubber bullets at you, and they hurt. I know because I got shot with a few of them. And Sergeant Jones, who was my guide, was a veteran of 3 deployments to Iraq, and he was chewed out a little bit for letting the journalist get shot. But I am truly uncoordinated and slow, so it wasn't his fault. But as you went through again and again and again, the idea was to simulate the chemical reaction that would occur when confronted with sudden developments in a culture not your own. And again and again and again, they prepared and they practiced and they practiced, so that when Marines landed in Anbar, they had a fighting chance of not making a bad decision and killing an innocent, and of not doing anything that would in any way besmirch the United States. That's the kind of practice you need with social media. You have to immerse yourself in it. You have to be completely ready for it. You have to train for any event that could occur in your social media life. It's a new dimension. It's a completely wonderful dimension when it comes to spreading the gospel. At our Monday night meeting, our friends in the Iranian ministry are so happy they have a Persian Bible. First new translation of the Bible into Persian, into Farsi in a generation. And they're very expensive. After which, my friend is deeply involved in a number of underground church efforts around the world, said, have you thought about putting it on a SIM card that you could put into a phone? Makes it a lot cheaper. And he's right, of course. You don't have to smuggle Bibles anymore that are big, lunky Bibles. You can just take it with you and download it. And it's a great thing. So we live in an era where it is possible to put the word everywhere in the world. So God bless the internet. That which is created is also perverted, and that which is perverted becomes a very dangerous thing. Point number five, from Charles Krauthammer, my favorite non-believer writer. He wrote this book, Things That Matter. It sold a million copies, a million copies. It's a collection of essays. As Dr. Mueller knows, this is unheard of. It's astounding in the world of publishing for a collection of already written pieces to sell 10,000, much less 100,000, much less a million copies. So what is it about that? Well, it helps to be on Fox News every night. It also helps to be wise. But I think it's the introduction. The introduction to Things That Matter has in it a very profound word. Politics are sovereign. Now, we don't believe that. Not most of us in this room. We believe that God and Jesus are sovereign, and that our faith is sovereign, and that God is on the throne. We believe that. But what he meant by that, in this life, in our calling, we must be involved in politics. We don't have a choice. And to that end, I want to encourage you to be deeply involved in politics. Whether you are of the left, of the right, or the center, you don't get a pass in America. Citizenship democracies do not allow you to take a vacation and devote yourself only to that pastime which encourages you, especially those of you of a scholarly bent who wish to live alone in the library, left with your books. That's not citizenship. I have a rule of 10. God gave us 10 fingers. This is lawyers who have to study for the bar always learn devices. And this is my device for citizenship. He gave you 10 fingers to see whether or not you're living your life as a leader and a citizen in the right way. That first finger is for your local church, and if you're not involved in one, you are not living life as you're called to live it. That second finger is for at least one parachurch ministry. For me, it is Young Life, into which you must be involved and invested in your time and your talent and your treasure, that great triple cliche that we've heard many times during Stewardship Month from many podiums. It's true. And so in your local church and in your parachurch, you must be giving your time, your talent, and your treasure. I believe personally the third finger represents an organization devoted to the men and women who serve the United States in the military and who have been wounded or in other ways disadvantaged by doing so. For me, it's the Injured Marine Semper Fi Fund, but there are many wonderful groups such as the Fisher House. There are also a lot of frauds. And I encourage you to find one of those groups like the Semper Fi Fund or Fisher House and to at least remember them with a small contribution every month, because we sit in this chapel free, able to declare what we wish to declare, not worried that ISIS will arrive at the back door and behead us because of the men and women in uniform. And so it is our obligation, especially as civilians, to remember them and to support them. Fingers four and five, two schools, at least one of which is not your own. You should be supporting them. You should find and praise the good. Lamar Alexander is one of my favorite men in politics. When he ran in 1996, I was a big Lamar guy, told me that on the tombstone of the great African-American novelist who wrote Roots, is Alex Haley, is the simple phrase, find the good and praise it. And that's what we ought to do with schools. And hopefully your alma mater deserves your support. And if it doesn't, then find two that do. Whether it's Southern Baptist Theological Seminary or Hillsdale College or Colorado Christian University or Biola or any of a number of great places, or high schools, or elementary schools, but find and support institutions that are devoted to traditional and honest-to-goodness learning. Then fingers 6 through 10, those are for candidates. Those are for people you should be supporting. Now, I always invest in candidates. That means give money. This past time around, I had 7. Ed Gillespie, Mitch McConnell, Tom Cotton, Cory Gardner, Dan Sullivan, Doug Ducey, and Adam Laxalt. It's all publicly reported, so I don't mind telling you that. It's all on database, as people know. I batted 6 for 7. Would that my Cleveland Browns do that well. Now, that they never have, actually, not since 1999. I know I'm in a part of the country that is burdened by being Bengals fans, primarily, and it's a sad, sad thing. God has called you to live with a terrible football team. But I know the Browns are coming back, and Thursday night, tonight, there's a great game between the Browns and the Bengals, and I want you to pray for the Browns. But anyway, those 6 successful investments, they weren't more important than the one that wasn't successful. The fact that you support losers is to be expected. That's American politics. But you gotta do it. You gotta pick people who you are willing to stand by, because otherwise they don't win. If you don't step up, they can't step in. And in American politics, if you're not running, you've gotta be supporting people who run. And we are called, especially as believers, to be deeply involved in politics in the right way. It is modeled here at the seminary. Sometimes it is done wrong, but more often than not, it's done correctly by men and women in ministry and in church affairs. Give yourself over to that. Now, I want to wrap up by using 3 examples from W. I find it difficult to overstate my admiration for President Bush. I'm in awe of what he did and the burdens that he carried after 9/11. And I want to tell you my 3 stories about President Bush that I think inform my view of leadership. The first comes from his last Wednesday in the Oval Office. His last Wednesday in the Oval Office, he summoned a half dozen talk show hosts to the Oval Office. And I was blessed to be among them. We spent an hour and a half with him. You know why he did that? It was off the record, so I can't quote him directly. This is not a direct quote, but I can summarize for you what the chief executive of the United States, who was leaving power, said to his conservative allies in talk radio. Give the new guy a chance. Support him. It's a very difficult job. When you have the opportunity to praise him, do so. Think about that. President Obama has not been overly generous with his praise of President Bush. That's an understatement. But President Bush ended his presidency by calling on people with the biggest microphones, and I have no doubt he did this as well in a one-on-one meeting with Rush. Al referred to my 2 million listeners. Rush has got 10 times that number. I'm quite certain he gave that same message again and again. Second W story. I was called to go down to Dallas 3 or 4 years ago, I can't remember which one exactly, to interview him in front of an audience at a fundraising event for Alliance Defending Freedom, a great, great organization. And the president said before he went out on stage, hey, listen, you can ask whatever you want, but I'm not gonna answer any questions about President Obama. And so I could answer, but he wasn't gonna criticize the president. And he never has. It's been 6 years. He has never criticized the president. He said obliquely, it does no good for a former chief executive to criticize the current occupant of the office. That is not, by the way, how Bill Clinton approached George W. Bush when George W. Bush was in the White House, but it's a wonderful lesson for leaders. You do not have, it is not part of your job to tear down those who went before you, even if you think they did a terrible job. That's not leadership. You're looking forward with the young people, you're looking backwards to honor their try, their attempt, even if you disagreed with them. My final W story. The first time I went to the White House to meet with him, again, he'd bring in talk show hosts all the time, and I got to do that twice. We were delayed. We were kept waiting in the Roosevelt room a little bit with Robe and a bunch of people, and then we came in, and the president apologized. He said, I've been on a teleconference with Prime Minister Maliki, trying to teach him how to be a leader of a free people. He did a lot of that. Spent a lot of time on the phone with people and on teleconferences with people who were trying to lead these new emerging democracies, sometimes not successfully, but he knew that's what it took in a free country. You've got to have men and women who step up and lead as Washington leads, honored on this campus, who could have been a dictator twice and walked away from absolute power twice. Or Churchill, defeated in the summer of his great victory in 1945, quitting office the next day, the people have spoken. What an amazing ethic to try and pass on to someone. Those 3 things about President Bush are amazing examples. And I want to close by leaving you with one other one. The best and the worst thing about being a leader is that you get to decide. You are, to quote W, the decider in chief. And if you want to be a leader, you got to look forward to making decisions. And that means you also have to take responsibility for those decisions. It's the best thing and the worst thing about being a leader. And I go here to the example that I do not know personally, but which I can absolutely prove took place. On the afternoon of July 11th, General Dwight Eisenhower, July 11th, 1944, came across a forgotten note that he had tucked inside of his wallet. He called in his naval aide, Captain Harry Butcher, who, taking the paper, read, quote, "Our landings in the Cherbourg area have failed to gain a satisfactory foothold, and I have withdrawn the troops. My decision to attack at this time and place was based upon the best information available. The troops, the air, and the Navy did all that bravery and devotion to duty could do. If any blame or fault attaches to the attempt, it is mine alone." That is leadership. He took a decision, and he was completely prepared to accept the responsibility for its failure. He would not scapegoat. He would not find an excuse. He would take it on his shoulders. I think in the person of Christ, we see the same thing. And I think in Eisenhower, whose faith journey is an incredible study, you see the completeness of leadership in America. It's a life well worth studying. And I thank you for the opportunity to offer these reflections and very much for the opportunity to be here on your campus. Thank you.